What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I'm Christy Penley, and I'm here with my friends, Matt and Ben.
Hey.
Hey, Christy.
Hi, Christy.
Hey, guys.
Nice to see you.
Yep.
You look like, Matt's stretching.
Yeah.
You need more coffee? Mm-hmm. Did you guys notice my name today? Need more coffee?
Yep. Hashtag need more coffee.
Hashtag need more coffee. I think I said before that sometimes I don't put my real name on things, so That's how I'm feeling today.
Yeah. You know, I'm feeling like, I think when I eat lunch and then all my blood, I think this is what the story I tell myself, all my blood rushes to my belly and then I want to take like a 3-hour nap. That's where I'm at right now. So you caught me mid-yawn, mid-stretch.
Mm-hmm. It's good. Well, I'm excited for our podcast today.
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's with Scott McKnight and he wrote this book called Tove, and I actually was very familiar with the people that were mentioned in that book. But also because Scott McKnight had a pretty significant impact on my husband and loving on my husband, being kind to him and taking him to a pub and listening and talking. And I just have really great memories with him. And you guys know him as well.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So Scott was a teacher at a college in Chicagoland 15 years ago. And, you know, your husband and I, Christy, went to the same seminary, and he would, like, hang out with us.
Yeah.
Because we were, like, asking all these questions, and this is, like, when the emergent church was bubbling up.
Yeah.
And post-modernity was the bad guy, and a lot of those of us, like, getting advanced degrees were like, well, we have so many questions, and we can't ask them. And Scott was like, gather around this table, and we'll talk about questions. he was such a pastorally good guy. Plus, he's kind of a dude. He's not your typical like stay in my office all day and read books and wear tweed jackets guy. He's like, I'm gonna watch a Cubs game while I write up my next book kind of guy.
while I smoke a cigar.
Yeah. So
yes,
I don't know, he felt really relatable, and you know, we stayed in touch since. And yes, I was excited for this interview too, Christy. All that to say.
Well, you know, what's really fun is that I pick a word every year, and I pick a word. Actually, it's probably started 20 years ago with my pastor, Dennis Jackson, and he challenged us to pick a word, to memorize scripture, to read books about it, to just kind of press in. And so I've done words, you know, like love and forgiveness and all these kinds of things throughout the years. This year's word, before I knew we were doing this podcast, was Tov. Which is a Hebrew word that means good or goodness, and really pressing in 2021 to what does that mean? And when I read his book and when we did the interview, there really was some healing, some really good healing in my heart after this interview, because I needed to hear some things that were said in that book and that he said in this podcast. So I'm just grateful, and it kind of all tied together, just in the timing of all of this. So let's get into this podcast and hear from Scott McKnight.
Yeah. Scott McKnight, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Good to be with you.
Yeah. Scott, for the two people of our listeners who've never heard of you and don't know anything about you, give us a brief introduction. What do you spend your time doing? What should we know about you?
Okay. I am a professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary. I think this is my eighth year. I taught 12 years at Trinity, 17 years at North Park University, undergrads, and then I think this is my eighth year at North Park, at Northern Seminary. So, and I use my time, I've spent a lot of time teaching and grading papers and interacting with students this since the middle of August. But last night I taught my last class of the fall term, and I have some time off now, so I'll be more focused on being able to do some writing.
Yeah. What's your current writing project right now? Anything specific?
Well, I am finishing up a commentary on the pastoral epistles for Cambridge University Press. And I finished 2 Timothy, and we've done 1 and 2 Timothy. And in the break, I'm writing articles. Here we go again with these earphones. AirPods won't stay in my ear. I'm writing articles for, I leave between projects, I leave little things. So I'm writing articles for the Dictionary of Paul and his letters. Oh. Second edition, one on Romans and one on James and Paul. And today I'll finish those. Then a little piece for a friend of mine in South Africa, and his name's Stefan Joubert, and on Paul's understanding of generosity. And then I'm going to start a book on Revelation.
So pretty much you're not busy. You're just on break, sounds like.
That's what my breaks are for.
Yes. And yeah. That was Christy Pinley, who's also joining us today. And Scott, many of our listeners know you as the curator and author of the blog Jesus Creed. I'll never forget, we met when I was at Trinity 15 years ago.
Yep, and I remember.
And I was sitting in one of my professors, I guess we're going to name names all throughout this podcast, so we might as well get started now. One of my professors, with the initials DA and the last name of Carson, was talking about his book, Becoming Conversant with Emergent. And he got this question. Some of this stuff needs to be talked about in shorter form. Would you ever consider having a blog? And Carson went on this, 90-second rant about how blogs were superfluous and, basically wasting your words and time because it was going into the vacuum of the internet. And I remember thinking, not Jesus Creed. even then, man, that blog was blessing me a lot.
Yeah, and I remember so much for what he was saying is that his TA, Andy Naselli, gave him a routine report of 90 different blogs. So... So that was a. Naselli told me this. I thought, okay, that goes in the face of what he was so much for superfluous. Yeah. Well, he's Carson's known for sitting in judgment on new things that are coming along, and it's just the way he's been.
Yeah. Well, Scott, we have the pleasure of talking to you today about the latest book that you co-wrote with your daughter, which must have been a unique and awesome experience for you. It's called A Church Called Tove, Forming a Goodness Culture that Resists Abuses of Power and Promotes Healing. this book is sort of two parts of this book. One is sort of a popular history told through you and Laura's lenses of kind of the church to blow up in the last 4 years, in particular centered right there in the suburbs of Chicago with Willow Creek and Harvest Bible Chapel. And then the second half of the book is maybe less of a expose and a history and more of a vision for how do we create churches that are resilient and resistant to abuse. Maybe to get us started, where did the idea of this book come from? How did you know you needed to write it?
Well, this is a little bit of a story, and it's kind of fun to tell for me because it involved Laura. When the story broke about Willow, well, I mean, first of all, Laura and Mark met at her husband, met at Willow Creek. Mark was on staff with the Willow Creek Association for many, many years. And they got us to start going, and we went to Willow Creek for about 10 years. And so we're interested. We care about Willow Creek. I defended Willow Creek. I got criticized for defending Willow Creek. And I still defend the parts that I think were really valuable. So when the story broke, I was sitting in our house with Chris. I started to read the story, and I told her, the Tribune is publishing an article about Bill Hybels and Willow Creek. I said, this is going to be serious stuff. So we read it, and as I was reading it, I said, this is true. This happened. Bill Hybels harassed and abused women. And because I knew those women's names, and I knew that they weren't going to be lying about this kind of story. So we sent the story to Laura, and Laura and Mark, as longtime attenders and members, started to communicate with us. And we just started talking back and forth. They were stunned by it all and really thought it was a bit of a joke that this story was going to be told at first, because they just couldn't believe that this would be true about Bill Hybels. But they lived in the luminosity or the middle land, numinosity, what word am I? Liminality, of thinking that, you know, they had learned so much and gained so much from Bill Hybels, and yet they loved Vonda Dyer and Nancy Beach and Nancy Ortberg, and they knew these women and thought, no way, this is really putting us in a difficult position. So we went back and forth for quite a while. One day I was traveling, and we had talked so much. I was traveling, and I was in an airport lounge, I think it was in Cincinnati, and I was just so much going on about the Willow Creek situation that I sat down and wrote out, oh, maybe 1,000 words of what I was thinking about it. Just to put it, you know, this is the way I process things. I write it out. So I put it on paper, and then I sent it to Laura and Mark, and we went back and forth, and I kind of edited and thought about it. Then I went to, this was March, I think I wrote it up in April. In June, I went with students to Turkey, Greece, and Italy. And when we came back, I called Laura maybe the next day and said, what's going on at the Willow Creek story? And she said nothing. And I said, well, something has to be done. Willow Creek is stalling in order to discourage the women and eventually silence them. So I believe it was that week, maybe it was Wednesday or Thursday, Laura took care of all these kinds of details, that I published my first blog post about it. And, you know, it made an impact. I was told that throughout the Willow Creek Church, South Barrington campus, everyone was reading it and talking about it. And, you know, at that point, I thought, okay, I've just made a lot of enemies, but I'm going to defend these women. I think these women are telling the truth, and by golly, somebody has to stand up for them, and people aren't. And I learned that pastors, you know, they're not going to say anything because they don't know, and they don't want people doing this to their church. And it's really difficult at times to know whether to speak up and or to just wait. So I spoke up, and then Steve Carter resigned, or he spoke up in a blog, and then he went back and forth with the elders, and eventually he resigned, walked off the stage, whatever, on a Sunday morning, and that just started unraveling as the story came out in the New York Times about Pat Baranowski. Suddenly, the Willow Creek people realized this happened, and we're in a difficult situation. So at that point, that's all I had done. I wrote a couple more blog posts, I believe, to try to clarify things, because Laura would ask me questions. I was getting letters constantly, people making comments on the blog, Facebook, Twitter, you know, some people saying I was just trying to get after Willow Creek, and that was just a bunch of nonsense. But you just have to learn to live with this when you write blogs. People are going to say things about you. That's the way it is. So then, this is really funny. Laura wanted me to write about it. I said, no, I don't want to write about it. I've got other things to work that I'm working on. And she said, no, I think you should. I said, well, no. Well, this is I've told this before, but this is what happened. I was reading a book on pastors in Germany and how they responded to Hitler after World War II was over. And I got to tell you, I was stunned by the parallels between how Willow Creek responded to the women and how the German pastors responded to accusations of their complicity in the Holocaust. I thought, okay. So I just started taking notes of the sorts of things. Can you hear me? I guess I could. I'm all right. I just started taking notes, and it was curious to me. I wasn't thinking of writing a book, but we were together with Lauren Mark at Christmas, and they started talking, and I said, you know something? I think we got something here. And I said, I'm not interested in writing an expose of Willow Creek. I'm just not interested in that. And I've been approached by publishers to do that. And I said, look, I'm not a church historian. I'm not an American historian. Both of those are needed to be really good at doing this, to set it in context. And I said, Willow Creek is not going to give me access to records. And that's what would be needed. So I said, no. But then I started studying this, and it became a chapter in the book called False Narratives. And those false narratives were an attempt to put together, in a sense, let's call this Augustinian human depravity when confronted with truth. How do people respond when they realize that someone knows their secrets? You know, they try to silence people, they lie, all these things. They spin the story, you don't understand me, etc. So I started putting that together, and we started working from there, and then it went in different directions. Laura wrote up a 40, maybe 50 page account of the story of Willow Creek. So that was the beginning of the book, and it's down to just a few pages now, but she had written about 50 pages. And so we started working there, and very early on, because of the blog post, I had come up with this idea of goodness, that we need to talk about goodness. And so I began to study the Hebrew word tov, which is the word for goodness, and how it's used in the Bible, and how important it is to a biblical understanding of, let's say, the proper kind of life as God designs it. So I started working with that topic, and Laura would work on stories, and I would say to her, you know, we need a good story about churches responding. She found this amazing story about Pastor Cunningham at Tate's Presbyterian Church. And so she started working that side. I would work the biblical side. I brought in some stories. She brought in some stories. She asked questions. She said, I have no idea what you're talking about here. So I would rewrite things. And eventually we went to Tyndale and asked them if they'd be interested with a co-authored book. And they did. And that's how it happened. So that's a long version, but it was really fun to work with Laura. She's a public school teacher, and she teaches grade school. So she had a whole summer. And I mean, that's what she did all summer. She worked and really liked it. She enjoys writing, and she can write. She has voice. She's learned, you know, to say it her own way. And so it was really fun to put that together.
Yeah, that's great, Scott. As I read, I was talking to Christy before we started recording. She and I both spent time in the suburbs of Chicago together. We were friends in grad school. And the church that we both found ourselves at, I was a pastor, and Christy was one on our preaching team. And we often joked, this was kind of a, it wasn't, this was true for some people, not all people. We often joked that our little church was Willow Rehab. We'd have people that would go to Willow Creek or Harvest Bible Chapel, and then would sort of spin out from those churches and kind of find their way to our little church. And Christy, actually, you can share a little bit about how you intersected with this. You actually taught at Harvest Bible.
Yeah, I was the Bible teacher for the junior high and taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and then also ran their chapel program at both of the campuses for 5 years until we moved to Colorado. And so it was fascinating to me as I read your book. I mean, I knew people. I knew the names. I knew the people, and I had been in that culture. And I'm glad... I'm just really thankful that you and Laura wrote this book, because I found myself in the reading the pages of this, Scott, that there was some healing. And I think that that was like the longing, your heart's desire, you and Laura, that you wanted women and people who had been in cultures that had been abusive to find some healing, that it didn't have to be that way, that there was Tove, that there could be a goodness culture that people live and work in, and I'm thankful that you wrote it.
Well, thank you. So you were at Harvest. I had forgotten that. So you experienced some of that culture firsthand. You know what we've heard from so many people, and this is, we get letters almost every day, and Laura gets some really amazing letters. And I think it's because she's so active on Twitter that people think, oh, I'll just write to her, and maybe this will get to Scott as well. And then, of course, she sends them to me. But, Christy, the amazing thing is the number of people who've told us that the book is giving them a language for their experiences. And, you know, to me, this is the language we need to use for these experiences. But it's almost like when you are a part of it, you don't have a language to describe what's going on. You're just experiencing it.
Yeah. And even in your experience, it's almost like it's foggy. It's just so not clear. And until maybe you get out of it, and obviously I'm out of it now for over 10 years, it just gets clearer and clearer. And you're right. The verbiage that you use, the language that you use, helped me be able to articulate what I felt, what I experienced, what I don't want to experience, in my next job, and what to look for.
Well, that's good. I'm sad that this was your experience, but we're glad that you're healing from it. And, I have a lot of friends who've been at Harvest. So I know some pretty serious stories that have happened there.
I guess, Scott, I want to turn to the Tove, because there's some really shaking, imagination-shaping practices that you give us in the second half of the book. But I wonder, like, how did we get to the place where the person we look to for leadership, who hosted the Global Leadership Summit, how do we get to the place where the paragon of leadership was actually an abusive, toxic leader, and we didn't know it and we couldn't name it? Like, that shakes a lot of people to their core, and it creates a lot of disillusionment and mistrust. Like, in your mind, like, why were we ill-equipped to see this and name this 15 years ago? What was missing?
wow, you know, this is the big one. And I don't think there is an answer to it in the sense that this is why it happened. But let me just put this out there to begin with, is that evangelicals valorize and make heroes of people. The bigger the hero becomes, in almost every case, the farther distant they become from us and the more of a persona they become to us. So all we see of Bill Hybels, and I'm not just blaming him here. You could talk about James McDonald. You could talk about any of these big mega church pastors, Craig Groeschel, for instance. The more that we valorize them and the bigger the church becomes, the more they become a wonderful face on a screen in a church. And when they become distant like that, we now don't know what's really going on behind closed doors. And the bigger they become, the bigger the church becomes, the farther people are from that person in most cases. Most of these mega church pastors, and I'm not going to say that this is characteristic of all mega church pastors. I'm not with your buddy David Fitch on this. I do have hesitations about mega churches, and I do think that there is a singular problem about them. But most mega church pastors do not pastor people. They probably pastor a few other leaders, but more they are leaders and directors and managers and administrators of other people, and then they become platform speakers who can attract a large audience. So that's one thing. The second thing is we valorize success measured by, I can't remember how Steve Carter said this, but it was amazing. Butts in seats, baptisms, and bucks in the plate. The three B's. If there are a lot of people coming to church, and if a lot of people are getting baptized, and if we've got a lot of money coming in, we are a success. Okay, that is a fundamental mistake. I mean, that is so deep-rooted as an error of what churches do that it's ineradicable in our evangelical culture, and it is theologically erroneous. What we need to measure as success is what I call Christoformity, Christ-likeness, character, tov. That's what needs to be measured for there to be talk about success. But we have gotten a pastor who's distant, and we have character divorced from success. We have Christoformity divorced from how we measure things. And now all of a sudden, as long as the institution, the church, the programs are succeeding and we can measure it, then we're doing the right things. Listen, we met, Laura and I and Chris, my wife Chris, met with a pastor recently who is a leader at Willow Creek. And this pastor, I won't give you name or gender or anything else, said Willow Creek lives in a feedback loop. In other words, they're always asking, what do people think? And if people like it, they keep doing it. If they don't like it, they don't do it. Well, that was the very thing that happened with the Reveal study, if you remember. Okay, I met with the person who designed the Reveal study, and her name is Callie. I said, Callie, I'm going to tell you, I'm a theologian. I'm a Bible guy. I don't think the way we measure things is whether the people in our church like it. I said, I think we measure things by whether we're faithful to the gospel or not. You know, sometimes faithfulness to the gospel leads to something not being liked. Well, if we go in a feedback loop of just saying, what do people think? And they don't like that idea, you better not preach on that again. Or they don't like that person that you use. Well, you know, that's too bad. Sometimes the gospel hits us where we're most vulnerable, often it does, and tells us that we're wrong and that we need to repent. But if we're always measuring whether people like it, we have a vicious cycle of, it's just nothing other than giving people what they want. And I'm not going to say that that's characteristic of mega churches. I don't know that. I mean, I've never talked to people like this about that topic. I did see that Reveal study, and it deeply concerned me. But I really don't know that that's characteristic. But if it is, it needs to be checked and repented from, because what we have to ask is whether that gospel that we're preaching is taking us to the wall and putting us in the corners that it's designed to do. So, okay, I think that's 3 points. I think those are 3 pretty good points, though, myself.
Yes, Scott. I mean, it's a pretty good answer to an unanswerable question.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Just a quick word. Most of you know this, but Gravity Leadership Academy is sponsored. No, Gravity Leadership Podcast is sponsored by Gravity Leadership Academy.
Yes.
Is what I meant to say. Which is our 10-month training and coaching intensive for Christian leaders. And we were just talking a little bit about the three of us are co-hosting the podcast today. We're just talking about cohorts. And Christy, you just were mentioning that you had just started a cohort, and it was your best first meeting of a Gravity Leadership Academy cohort that you'd ever had.
And it was.
I was just like, why?
Yeah, it really was.
Let's hit record and figure this out.
Well, so I have these 8 women, and number one, we're super spread out. So there's people in Indonesia and people in America and people. Anyway, it's really fun to kind of just have the diversity of that. But our very first meeting, and I've done this a lot, like where I've led through cohorts, but our very first meeting, all of the women on there were the most vulnerable and the most authentic that I've ever seen a group be in the initial meeting. It really did flabbergast me in a way that was surprising and beautiful and exciting for what the future is going to be. Because I actually said to a girl in the group, typically you get that kind of unity or vulnerability maybe in the middle to the end, but to start there it just makes me so excited for what the end is going to be. So these women are hungry and are willing to kind of open up, unzip a little bit, and let us see their hearts. And so I'm excited.
That's great. Yeah, that's really encouraging to hear. I've had cohorts like that as well where, I don't know what it is, but something syncs up right away. And it's a really normal process for people to sort of feel things out as they move into it. You know, it doesn't mean it's going to be a bad cohort, but it just means like, It's kind of weird to try to connect online with people that you don't know,
right?
And that kind of thing. And so, but the vulnerability is really a key part of it. People learn how to share what's really going on because we believe God meets us right where we are really at.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that cohort too. Christy, you have led quite a few of these locally in your own church. You've led more of these than I have. I feel like. Maybe. No, I'm joking.
It's true. It's probably true.
But it might be true. What is it about, and this is, this is a big reason that you're co-hosting the podcast with us. You love what this is all about. But what is it about leading people through this and going through it yourself? You've been through this yourself like 2 or 3 times as well. What is it about it that makes you want to continue to participate in this process.
Yeah, Ben, I do believe in it. It has been one of the most transformational times in my life. Initially, I went through the first cohort with Matt, and he was done, and I was like, I'm not done. I need to go through it again. And he was like, what? And so I just did it again the next year with him, because that's awesome. Because the Spirit was doing such work in my heart, and really, like, I did not have language. I believed in what Gravity Leadership was doing, and I wanted that, and I fought for that, but I didn't really have the language until I had gone through the cohort. And I didn't really have eyes to be able to see, nor really express, because I didn't have the language, of God being active and present, and recognizing Him, noticing what He was doing, and really going through the process of what are the lies that I'm believing. And in my life, I would kind of notice something and then I would want to fix it.
Yeah.
And that was my discipleship model. And there was such a miss.
It seems correct, doesn't it? I mean, it seems good. Wouldn't you want to fix it?
Yeah, but it's a big miss. Yeah. So for real life change, I saw it in myself, and I've seen in lots of people who have gone through this. They look and they say, they talk about their journeys with Jesus. In fact, I actually got a text of somebody who was in your cohort, Matt, just this week. And well, I think that you're done with it, but he was just praising Gravity Leadership and just saying how the Lord used it. It was instrumental in his life as he journeyed with Jesus. And so I believe in it. I know I sound like a commercial, and that it's like, please don't hear that. It's really my heart. I just, to the point where I've paid for other people. I'm like, I believe in this. I want you to do it.
Yeah. Well, stories like that, Christy, I appreciate you sharing that. Stories like that are what get me out of bed in the morning. You know, on the hard days, make me realize that, okay, God's at work and this is all worth it.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that. And listeners, if you would like to check it out, we're starting new cohorts all the time. We're starting one this month, actually, that I'm going to be leading, at least one this month. And if you're interested in checking it out, go to gravityleadership.com/academy to get all the details. And feel free to reach out if you have any questions, podcast@gravityleadership.com.
Yeah. You tell the story in this book about some of the toxic or abusive ways that churches handle accusations. One of them I just wanted to mention as part of my story. You mentioned that people who have experienced abuse or bringing allegations of abuse are often told to follow Matthew 18, right? So the woman who maybe had a weird encounter with her pastor, she's told, have you gone directly to him yet? And have you, you know, shared this with him? Maybe for those who are listening, that would maybe be their first instinct. If there's an allegation of something that went wrong, then it has to be worked out. Matthew 18, could you maybe give us a little vision about how that's not the whole story, or why that's insufficient when there's a power or gender dynamic at work?
Yeah. Okay. This depends in part upon what happened here, right? What the allegation is. But Matthew 18 essentially says, if you have something against a brother, go tell him. A sibling, go tell him. And you may gain him. If not, then bring in someone else, then two or three. And if that doesn't work, then go to the whole church. If that doesn't work, kick him out. Okay. All right, that's a pretty good strategy, that if you offend someone or you are offended by someone, to talk to them. This is a sort of egalitarian framework where we talk to one another when we have offenses with one another. So if, I think we can deal with that. That was pretty clear. But what happens when it is sexual abuse by a male against a female? Just that right there is a power dynamic in most cases. Most men have more power. Okay, now let's just make it a pastor. Now, when a pastor does this, A pastor is a mediator, a priest, in the perception of most people. Even the people who are as low church as you can get, they actually believe that their pastor speaks with God and has mediated God's grace to them in different ways. All right. So now we have a female who has been harassed or abused by a woman, and she's supposed to go talk to that pastor. Okay, a couple things. Number one, she's putting herself in a position of being re-abused almost always. Secondly, the power dynamic is so unequal that the allegation being put before the pastor is going to be overpowered by the pastor himself. So to me, it is a mockery of Matthew 18 to ask a vulnerable woman to confront her abuser privately. And I know that in most of these cases, these pastors would not permit another person to be in the room because they have everything to lose and nothing to gain. So it's a power abuse. It's a sexual abuse. It's going to trigger. It's going to re-abuse the woman. And the history of this is just not that way. It doesn't work. So to me, it's a misuse of Matthew 18 to think that it applies in every circumstance. So when they were using it, my daughter said, "Dad, everybody is saying that the women who went to the Chicago Tribune are not following Matthew 18. She was saying this. She was hearing it from all these Willow people. Well, I wasn't hearing it. I wasn't paying attention to those Twitter pages and Facebook stories. I didn't see it. Then they were appealing to the pastoral epistles that you should never make an accusation against an elder apart from two or three witnesses. Okay. So I said, all right, I understand they want to be biblical, but I said, you know, there is actually a text in the Bible about this in Deuteronomy that completely goes at it from a different angle. And the angle is the woman's story is believed because no one was there to watch it. Hmm. Now that, when I brought this up, it was like, I heard some people say, well, it's the Old Testament. Yeah, that's the book of Jesus. That's the one he was using, okay? And when the two or three witnesses that Jesus used, that Paul used, that came from the Old Testament too. So that text was actually played an important role at Willow, that they realized they need to be more careful about using Matthew 18. And I hope more people pay attention to that little text in Deuteronomy 22. So then the other one with the you have to have two or three witnesses to accuse an elder. I just simply have said this over and over. How many times does a pastor sexually abuse a woman in the presence of someone else? You know, the chances are very low. These are done in private, you know, when they know no one's looking. So at that case, you're not going to have two or three witnesses most of the time, but it's more important than that. In the Willow case, they did. They had as many as 10 women who had talked. And what do you want? What kind of evidence do you need? And so I think that we need to be a little bit wiser and discriminating and discerning in which texts we think apply in which circumstances. So that's one thing we learned.
Scott, can I just say thank you? Like I kind of have like a little bit of a stomach ache because I'm thinking of all of these women who need to hear that. There just are too many. One is too many, but there are so many in this nation and across the world that have experienced that are silent, that don't feel empowered by the men in their life who will stand up like you are standing up now, or that Matt, that you have stood up. I just really appreciate it and just want to say thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. And we're glad that we get to play a part in this. It is extraordinarily frightening for women to come forward. They are so overpowered to begin with. They're questioning God.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually told Matt before you got on, I've worked at several different churches since Harvest, and I had a situation where I was in a meeting with my boss, and I was at a coffee shop. We were in a public place, and he reached his hand over and put his hand on mine and left it there. And it was weird. It was awkward. It was inappropriate. It made me feel not okay. And I came home. I told my husband, and he said, "You should tell him." Now, I feel like I'm strong. I mean, I feel like I'll tell you, but there was something in me that was like, that sounds terrifying. Even a hand on a hand. I mean, it was nothing beyond that, but a hand on a hand was terrifying to me. And I did. I actually went to my boss the next day and said, "I need to have a meeting with you." And I said, "This made me feel uncomfortable, and this is not okay. And here are the reasons why," and la la la. And he responded so humbly. So he was like, "I am so sorry. I meant compassion. I didn't mean anything else. But you know what? I'm going to go home and tell my wife. I'm going to have my wife call you. And like, I want you guys to have a conversation." There became like a policy for that church that I was working at, that then became, how do you handle situations like this? And you're not going to go to the person, right? You need to have somebody else who can stand up for you and who can hear your story with compassion and empathy. But it was interesting to me, like that small thing felt very terrifying to me, that I can't imagine, bigger stories that women have and the ways that they've been abused. There's no way that they can go. They need someone to stand up for them.
But I mean, even then, I mean, look at the women that Bill Hybels was harassing. Let's just say harassing, all right?
Abusing. These aren't shrinking violets. These are
no.
These are
Nancy, right? Orberg's tough. She's strong. Vonda Dyer went to Bill and said, "Knock it off." And and yet they were dragged through the mud in public. False accusations, spinning of stories, things said about them that weren't true, jobs lost, fired, demotions, all kinds of things. We know a woman at Willow who lodged an allegation and said something. And the next Monday, her office was moved to some place next to a bathroom so it would be interrupted with noise all day long. And this is just the beginnings of the sort that we're right now. Laura's in communication with a young woman who is alleging stronger allegations than anything we've heard about a person with a lot of status. And scared to death. I mean, this is frightening. And even having someone like me or Matt or you, Christy, to defend her or to come to her defense is not enough, because you have to be able to lodge an allegation in such a way that it will succeed. And it's these women at Willow Creek did not know one another and did not know one another's stories, because that's the way it works. So it was only when it started to come public that other women were able to come forward, and then the mass of numbers or the numbers was allowed to hit home. And so this young woman that Laura is in communication with is alone. And there's no way for it. It's scary. And, you know, I can't publicly vouch that this story is true. I mean, very few of them are lies, but it's something that you have to be very careful about. And this is why, you know, some of the women said to me, why are pastors not standing up for us?
Yes.
And I said, because they'll be sued. They are afraid just as much as you are, because they don't know what happened. They believe you. It's your word against another person's word, because this occurred in private. It's very difficult. But when 7-10 people come forward with a similar story, you know, all of a sudden it gets really credible. Everybody starts believing. And then it, so it's really hard. And I, that's why we dedicated the book to what we call wounded resistors. People who resisted the toxicity in a church, but were wounded because they resisted. And they resisted right. They did the truth, but they suffered for it.
Yeah. Yeah, Scott, I think the first part of the book is powerful in the sense that it names like the fear-based, narcissistic, toxic sort of culture that sort of surrounds a pastor and enables this abusive, toxic leadership to exist. I actually was thinking, I don't know if you have a comment on this. This is tangentially related, but I was thinking about the people who get caught up. There was a couple stories about people who were on staff at these churches and got caught up in the system that was toxic, and how they found themselves being complicit in or giving sort of credence to abusive, toxic things that they wouldn't necessarily outside of that system have chosen to give credence to or do. Mm-hmm. And just how the totality of the system actually creates another layer of, I don't know how you would describe it, responsibility, but also agency. Like, it's like, and I was just thinking about how there's these conversations about how about race in our culture, and how racism is something that exists not just in personal prejudices, but in systems and structures. And I'm like, and that's another power thing. And I guess as I read your book, I just kept thinking about how I am so ignorant about how power is at work in these systems. And if it wasn't for these stories from these women, or some stories from my Black brothers and sisters about how power impacts them and changes how they act and how they experience the power from somebody like a Bill Hybels, like it just wouldn't be on my radar at all. I just wouldn't notice it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you felt that or interacted with that as you began to uncover these stories.
Well, yeah. I mean, this was a part of the trying to come to terms with how to explain some of this stuff. I mean, we know some people who were corrupted by these other leaders. And we know some people who were involved in this. I know someone at Harvest who was not corrupted, who tried to resist and eventually left, okay? Who resisted and tried to make a difference. It didn't work and left. But some people are corrupted by all this. But Matt, I think part of the thing that you're getting at is a statement that we use several times by David Brooks. I'm not inclined. I don't read all of David Brooks. I do like him. I think he's pretty shrewd. But David Brooks talks about how never, I think a quotation's about like this, never underestimate the power of the workplace where you work to make you the kind of person who fits in that kind of workplace. Yes. Something like this. Okay. Now, Matthew Krausman is associated with Miroslav Volf at Yale. Krausman is a pastor, vineyard pastor, who's written an amazing dissertation on sin as an agent, that it is an emergent agent, that individual sins create a culture of sin that becomes an agent that acts back upon the humans to keep doing that because it makes it more comfortable because you fit in that culture. And I would say that if you just add up the characteristics of a toxic church culture, you just simply have to recognize that that is an agent. Toxicity becomes an agent of toxicity that makes you like this. And Laura found some stories of people who were in a church culture and found themselves being out of character. They had become mean because that's what the culture promoted them to be. And they didn't even recognize it. It's the color of water, Matt, Christy. It's the air we breathe. And before long, it's the way you are. And you look back 5 years and say, how did I become that way? Mm. So that it's the emergent properties, and Matthew Krausman has all the technical terms for it, but it's called subservience and downward causation. But in just a simple circle, at the bottom are the individual acts of toxicity, and at the top of the circle is the agent that acts back down upon the person as the sins develop the character of, let's say, sin as an agent. Well, I believe that Tov is the same way, that if we learn the practices of Tov in a church, it can become an agent. And I don't know, but you've been around people who are positively Tov, at least you think they are. And when you're around them, you find themselves behaving like that person or that culture. Yes. That's systemic Tov or systemic toxicity. And Tov doesn't happen because we preach a series on it or because we read that in Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit is goodness. All of a sudden, well, okay, we're going to have Tov. Well, that's not the way it works. It has to become a culture for it to become an agent for a church culture. And that's where we got to work.
Yeah, you name Mr. Rogers in his biography as one of the stories in there. That little section about how he did his quote, devotional time and his imaginative prayer. Scott, that blew me away. It blew me away.
I had a lot more pages on Mr. Rogers, but they, you know, you can tell a lot of stories about him. He's the real deal on Tov.
Yeah. Well, so you name Tov, and I want to name him real quick, and then Christy, I'd love to hear which one struck you and stood out to you if you have questions about him. But you name that Tov churches, they nurture these things: empathy, grace, people first, truth, justice, service, and Christ likeness. And you've got tangible, relational, granular ways that those are inhabited in each chapter. Christy, which one of those struck you as maybe the most important for your life, or the one you had the most curiosity about?
Yeah, I think the first thing that came to mind as I read those is the people first. Because I do think in a culture where there is no Tov, it's the leader first, it's reputation first, it's, you know, their identity first or whatever. And so actually I said to Matt before you came on, Scott, I kind of wish that there was like an evaluation, some sort of like 10 question quiz to like help churches, cultures be able to kind of ask these questions about are we a culture that is good, that there is goodness and that it's seen? Because I think it's really important. And I think too many times churches are more interested in those three B's that you mentioned before, Scott, rather than actual people.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, okay, this is a very interesting issue. And I don't believe that most mega churches have the infrastructure to make people first. All right, now if you notice, we almost never use a church that is existing as a positive example, because you never know. Okay, so we We didn't want to use any that something might backfire on us, you know.
Yeah.
So we used Mr. Rogers, and we used that Tate's Presbyterian because that was a story that they did it right. They might be toxic. They're not, but if they were, it wouldn't affect that story. Okay. I know that Andy Stanley's church, I've been there a number of times, and I know some of their leaders, that they say that they are small groups that meet together on Sunday. All right? All right, I think, okay, now that, I can handle a mega church that operates this way, if it actually operates that way. Because then every person is in a small group, every person who's committed to this church. You know, you got a church that big and you got speakers that are that amazing and entertaining and, you know, you learn from them and grow. When you have that many, you're going to have a lot of people just showing up and not being committed. But let's just say you take the committed people. I remember attending Willow one time thinking, what if I had a heart attack and died? Who would take care of the funeral? You know, I had no idea. I know it wasn't going to be. I didn't know Bill Hybels. I had never met him. I've met him since, but I at that time. All right. I believe that the only legitimate understanding of a church is when everyone is known by name to people that matter, let's say, as leaders or pastors in the church, and where their story is becoming known, and where their story is becoming part of that church's story. Yeah. That's when it's a church. Mm-hmm. Until then, it's possibly on the way. And so people first means you know people's names. I did not like something. I loved teaching a course this fall on the book of Revelation. But because of some things going on at Northern, they allowed a lot of students in the classroom, and I had, you know, 55 or something like that in a classroom, and almost everyone was online. In the last 3 or 4 weeks, it was all online because of COVID. I did not like not knowing some of those faces out there. They were there.
Right.
And it was a part of our program. And okay, I like the classes when I know the students' names. And all of a sudden, you know, I know her story. And I know what I just said is going to really bother her. Or he is going to be really irritated by what I said. Or this, I just said this because that person needed to hear this kind of gracious word, you know. So that, I think, is what teaching and pastoring is about.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the people first, is knowing people's names. I think it was Maya Angelou. Did Maya Angelou also teach? I told the story one time in a sermon. I think she taught at Duke. Which one of the... I think she taught literature at Duke. Hmm. And the first day of class, I think it was Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison maybe. The first day of class, everybody introduces themselves. The second day of class, they do it all over again. And someone said, why are we doing this again? He said, because you didn't learn other people's names last week. We need to learn one another's stories. This is the heart of church life. Knowing names, knowing stories. That's what it means to put people first. And I got to tell you that it was in my mid-50s when some of these names began slipping from me, and it really bothered me. Because I took pride in knowing my student's name on the second time we met, every student.
Yeah.
I'd go through my picture lists, and I had to know who they were. It was really important to me. And then in my mid-50s, I'd come back after the fall term, and I couldn't remember some of the names of the first term. I went, oh, boy. I wondered if I had Alzheimer's, you know. But I think that's so important. And one time, I had a student teacher at North Park who came to me after a couple weeks and said, I have a student in my front row who can't stand me. I said, well, how do you know he can't stand you? He said, well, he just has that look about him. And I said to him, what's the student's name? He said, I have no idea. I said, okay, here's two things to do. I said, number one, I want you to learn his name. I want you to stand at the door so that when he comes to class every day, you greet him by name. See what happens. I saw him about 2 weeks later. I said, how's it going with that student? He said, man, we just had coffee together. We've become friends. And you know, it's the same thing, Christy. He learned his name. That is like the magic of acknowledgement. That's so big. I totally with you. It's wonderful.
Yeah, maybe to close here, Scott, I remember 15 years ago, you and I having a pint at one of the pubs in Libertyville. And I was asking you why you decided not to teach graduate students anymore, why you were teaching undergrad students. And I don't know if you remember this, but you told me, I get to teach the Gospels to a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds, and half of them don't know Jesus. And you just lit up as you told us, you know, you had about 8 ounces of beer in you. Maybe that was lighting you up. But I also think it was the evangelism. And you were telling us how you get to proclaim the gospel from the Gospels to these college students, and they come to you after class, and they talk about their lives, and they come to realize that Jesus has a real, tangible meaning and significance in their actual lives. I think I just want to let our listeners know that this isn't the second half of the book that we barely touched on. It isn't abstract and academic. It's very tangible in terms of answering the question, what are people for? Yeah. What are they for? And if you have this institutional inertia where people actually fit into the machine and people are either a threat to the brand or there's something you can use to build the brand, then you're going to create these toxic environments where power is abused and people get hurt. But if people are for, like what you've just named, Scott, and you've named Christy, if people are actually to be known and welcomed and received and seen, then we can begin to build. It's one artifact of many you name where we can begin to build a culture that is resistant to abuse.
Yeah, yeah.
It's allergic to it.
Yep.
Right?
I mean, it detects it, sees it.
It's an immune system. Tov is the immune system of the kingdom of God, right? And it becomes resilient. Scott, thank you so much for spending time with us. Your book is really good. I echo Christy's sentiments. I've encountered some abusive and toxic environments in my life, and I also felt seen and known and also redeemed as I read. So it could be a hard read for many of our listeners, but I think it's a significant and needed read for many too. So thanks a lot. And will you pass on appreciation to Laura for us too?
I will. And good to meet you, Christy. Yes, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Great to be with you, too.
And I remember that time at Mickey Finn's in Libertyville.
We had several. They were awesome.
Yeah, that was fun.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebbe, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.